The introduction clearly stated that I had been going on a negative point of view yesterday, presenting specifically the weaknesses in modern historiography, the modern interpretations of history, and the problems which emerge from those various weaknesses. But first, allow me to enlarge upon the bibliography which I gave you yesterday. I got a feeling of pressure in time and did not finish it, and I skipped some of it. Allow me again to go back to the lectures of last week to give a few further books that will be of great help to you in understanding the biblical approach to philosophy. And I should have given you yesterday and did not, but I think is probably the best of all these books, namely Cornelius Van Til, The Defense of the Faith. Along that line, I would also suggest Jerusalem and Athens, a series of commentary lectures, or I should say chapters, on the position of Van Til by a group of scholars, I think about 20 if I remember correctly, from Africa, Europe, and North America, and perhaps one or two other places. There is appearing a book on Van Til. I think it's to come off the press in September, the title of which nobody yet knows. But it is being edited by Rush Dooney and Gary North, I think also, for which Dr. Lee contributed two chapters, and I contributed one fairly long chapter, 35 or 40, 45 pages, on Van Til's view of history. In addition to that, I would also recommend Gordon Clark's The Christian View of Men and Things. Gordon Clark's The Christian View of Education, which is really a discussion of the philosophy of education. And Ronald Nash's work as editor of The Philosophy of Gordon Clark, to which I also contributed, but at this time I contributed his view of the state. This was published 3 or 4 years ago. Ronald Nash is professor at Western State College in Kentucky. I would also make some other suggestions concerning secular approaches to history. And one book which is not secular, and yet which is a neo-orthodox presentation of history, and yet I do think, following what Dr. Smith said, that we should be familiar with the neo-orthodox approach to history, simply to be on our guard. And that is Otto Pieper's book, God and History. It's a very deceptive book because it uses evangelical phraseology with abandon. Less deceptive because it is less evangelical in this sense is Reinhold Niebuhr's Faith and History and another book called The Self and History, which is a little later than his Faith in History. These books are frankly neo-orthodox, and unlike Pieper's book, have a much less evangelical overtone and appeal. I would also recommend to you, and you may think this is very strange, but I do think you ought to read Das Kapital. I never put a premium on the ignorance of Christians as to what is going on. And I think we have to understand the Marxian doctrine of history. The best place to get it is in Das Kapital. Another good place, of course, is in the Communist Manifesto, which was an earlier work which appeared early in 1848. We should also understand Auguste Comte, Vico, as forerunners of 19th century evolutionary and materialistic views of history. We should also, I think, from this point of view, read Herbert Mueller, The Uses of History, a very interesting book in which he concludes that history has neither use nor meaning. And I mentioned him the other day as being rewarded for this by being sent to Iran, purposes I would never understand. I would, with some modesty, suggest that you read my book on Toynbee. Not because I'm an admirer of Toynbee in some respects, in many respects, but because in that book I apply a biblical standard of historical interpretation to Toynbee. And thus my criticisms of Toynbee are rather different from those of the usual critic of Toynbee, who attacks him for various problems, one of which he is accused of being Augustinian, which of course he is most decidedly not. For an insight into the evolutionary philosophy of history, I would recommend Karl Becker's The Heavenly City of the 18th Century Philosophers. Karl Becker, a very able American historian of the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and early 40s, wrote from the point of view of sheer optimism, and he captured very brilliantly the optimism of the French and the American revolutions. He's referring, of course, particularly to the optimism of deism. And that book is a result of his studies. His last book is, of course, a very interesting book in which he shatters his previous optimism, a book which he called Modern Democracy, in which he concludes that all is lost. He wrote that just before his death in the fairly late 1940s. He was a very famous professor of history at Cornell University. Now let me make some introductory statements as we come to those writers who really approach the meaning of history. May I point out to you that a philosophy of history in the non-Christian world is the product of the prevailing philosophy of that era. If you care to use the word zeitgeist, I would. And a philosophy of history reflecting the basic philosophy of the day tends, particularly in the modern era, to have a great effect upon the actual development of history in that day. So that increasingly, I would say since the French Revolution, the various views of history have in turn had a tremendous impact upon the actual unfolding of the historical process. I shall do more with this in a few minutes. I simply point it out now for what it is worth to you as some of the basic underlying understandings which you might want to carry with you. That a philosophy of history is not a peripheral concept, particularly since Kant and Hegel and Marx and the encyclopedists and the philosophes of the French Revolutionary period, because they had a tremendous effect upon history. Let me give you a more important picture. That the civilization of any era tends to reflect the basic philosophical currents of that era. We would hold that man is a rational being. He thinks. Thus, the basic philosophical concepts of an era tend to imprint themselves upon that era. Let me give you a few examples of what I mean. We speak of the Baroque as an era. Music, literature, and art reflect the basic concepts of that particular era. We speak of the Renaissance as an era, and rightly so, in one way at least. Thus, the art, the architecture, the music, the political thought, the literature, and so on, reflect the basic philosophic concepts of the era of the Renaissance. Likewise, this is also true with the Reformation. But the Reformation was not merely a reformation of theology. It was that, of course, and had to be. But there's a world of difference between the aesthetic concepts of the Reformation on the one hand and those of the Renaissance on the other. Or the political philosophy of Calvin and those of Machiavelli. It's almost blasphemous, I suppose, to even mention them in the same category. But there's a world of difference. The educational philosophies of Calvin at Geneva are far, 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 far cry from those of Erasmus at Oxford or someplace else. Now, having given those introductory statements, let's now go back for a moment to the Greco-Roman world and very briefly examine the Greek or the classical view of what history is all about. Greek thought imposed on Greek historical writing a cyclical view of human events, a cyclical view which logically denied that history has meaning or purpose. The Greeks did not believe that history has meaning or purpose. If I were more artistic, I believe I could do a better job on the blackboard. But when you think of the Greek view of life, you think of the architecture of the Eastern churches. The dome, the bowl, the huge dome, let us say, of St. Sophia. This is an architectural indication of the closed nature of the Greek universe. On the other hand, you look at a great medieval cathedral, and you walk into that cathedral, and the whole architecture of that cathedral draws your eyes upward to the great vault, the pyramid structure. It forces you to look up. And whether we entirely agree with St. Thomas or not, and we don't, nevertheless, however imperfect that theism may be of the Middle Ages, it was a theism, giving glory to God. And the medieval cathedral is an indication of the basic underlying assumptions of the Middle Ages. Incidentally, of course, the medieval cathedrals began to be built long before St. Thomas. Approximately, they were started somewhere around 1050 or 1100. There are differences of opinion there. But nevertheless, they represent a more pure medieval theology of the Anselmic period. Thus, the Greek thinkers held to a view of a closed universe, and they were never able to free themselves from this view. And it permeates their concept of history. They were never able to free themselves from the shackles of their secular scholarship to achieve a satisfactory conception of history. A conception which did justice to their own philosophy or their own religious aspirations. For the Greeks, God, and I use the word with hesitancy, God was impersonal. In the earliest of the Greek historians, Herodotus, he is to theon, not ho theos. Now, in Greek, your genders are of tremendous importance. And when the Greeks spoke of God as to theon, they meant an impersonal being. Thus, for them, history is under the control of an impersonal being. They knew nothing of a sovereign God, the triune God of the scriptures. And so, being incurably religious by the very fact they were created in the image of God, they invented replacements according to their own presuppositions. They created their own God. When Herodotus spoke of God, he spoke of him in terms which very clearly show that the deity, at best, is an impersonal deity, an impersonal force, which completely determined the historical process, and thus deprived man of his freedom and of his responsibility. We hear humanist worship, the Greek view of democracy, and the Greek view of life. Let me tell you that the so-called and highly vaunted democracy of Athens lasted about 30 years in the age of Pericles. That's all it lasted. Greek thought, Greek political thought, naturally produced despotism. It was no accident that the Roman world ended with the despotism of a Diocletian. It was a logical conception, the logical result of Stoic political philosophy. May I say this, and this will probably surprise you. The only era in the Western world having a political philosophy which did not naturally and almost inevitably produce a despotism was the Middle Ages. And I'm far from saying the Middle Ages were perfect. I have made that point very clear. But when you read a man like John of Salisbury in his Polycraticus, when you read the other medieval commentators, and when you realize the basic nature of common law and the basic nature of medieval feudalism, you must remember that American and English constitutionalism were derived from feudalism. Feudalism was the one political philosophy which gave birth to common law and which did not naturally produce despotism. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that there were not despots in the Middle Ages, because there were also human beings in the Middle Ages. There were rulers who were greedy for power. I'm not unmindful of Frederick II, who was probably a Mohammedan, if he was anything. I'm not unmindful of some of the popes, who were certainly not Christian, and goodness knows what they were. I'm not unmindful of some of the power-drunk popes, who rivaled the power-drunk emperors, for the supreme power. I'm also mindful, however, of a man like Louis IX, St. Louis of France, whose reign in France is often regarded as a golden reign. I'm mindful of Henry I or Henry II in England, who were men of great ability and high character. I'm mindful of all of this. All I'm saying is this, that Greek thought and modern thought naturally produced despotisms. And modern history is the scene of one despotism after another. Microcosmically, of course, in Florence, Venice, and the Italian city-states. We fail to realize that they were despotisms. We don't think they're very dangerous because they were Italian city-states. And from that point of view, they weren't, so far as their impact was concerned. But they were despotisms. Classical philosophy, which hung over classical culture like a mantle of death, also hung over the classical view of history and brought classical thought to a dead end. Gilbert Murray, who was no friend to Christianity, wrote, and wrote well, that classical culture died because it had lost its nerve. And this is true. The classical world, whether it was Greek or Roman, whether it was Herodotus or Pliny or any other Tacitus or any other Roman writer, never was able to free itself from the shackles of Stoic paganism. And in so, it helped to contribute to the downfall of the Roman world. But as I said last week, out of the debris of classical culture, there arose a new school of thought in the early fathers of the Christian church to give Western culture as a whole a new sense of importance, a new sense of direction, a new sense of meaning. Such an impulse, of course, was implicit in the very nature of the Christian doctrine that they were studying. But as I pointed out last week, most of the fathers were very, very slow to comprehend the import of the doctrine which they were setting forth. Now, this could be a criticism, and yet, when you realize the task which was theirs, the task of somehow finding a place for their Christian doctrine in the classical world, you begin to appreciate the monumental and staggering implications of what they were trying to do. They first had to come to a clear conclusion as to the meaning of the Old and New Testaments. This body of Christian truth is suddenly thrust upon them. They are brought into it by conversion as mature pagan adults. I'm thinking, of course, particularly men like Tertullian, Justin Martyr, Clement of Alexandria, and so on. They had a tremendous task, and it took them at least 400 years to develop a biblical theology which was adequate for the task of carrying out their cultural mandate. And, of course, as I pointed out last week, these early church fathers, to varying degrees, were influenced by the classical culture. One of the really ironic points is Tertullian. With his famous declaration that Jerusalem has nothing to do with Athens, he set forth his case in beautiful classical Latin. He wrote well. He coined a few phrases, like the word Trinity, to state his case, but he coined it out of Latin. He was a trained Roman lawyer, and so he uses Roman logic to set forth his case. He knows classical philosophy, and so he says we should separate it, and he writes beautiful descriptions of the classical philosophy from which he's separating, which showed the dilemma in which he was wavering, as well as the concepts which he was using. I don't mean to criticize him, because I can appreciate his problems. Now, we come to Augustine. Born in 354 A.D., and dying in 430 A.D., his lifespan of 76 years covered the last dying gasps of the Roman Empire. He was born in the middle of the 4th century, when the golden age had turned to silver, and the silver turned up brass and copper. He, as a young man, had weltered in the paganism of his day, having been reared by a godly mother at the age of 17. He had gone far, far astray. He dabbled in all the philosophies. He had acquired an illegitimate offspring, and he had wallowed in the mires of the sin of the dying days of the Roman Empire. A brilliant man, he was teaching rhetoric which is more than public speaking, and he heard about a character up in Milan by the name of Ambrose, one of the great fathers of the church. He had no use for Ambrose, but he did want to be a good rhetorician, and Ambrose was the pulpiteer par excellence in the early church. He was a great preacher. As Bishop of Milan, he'd done a tremendous job. And so Augustine went up there one day to hear this character. As we would say, they see what made him tick. And when he walked in the church, he became Augustine the Christian. For he found out what made Ambrose tick. Not his rhetoric, which was superb. Not his administrative ability, which is great. Not his great sermons, which are good for that day. But Augustine was converted. And within a very few years, he became Bishop of Hippo, a very small town in North Africa, really on the site of ancient Carthage. And he became the last and the greatest of the North African fathers. And from the vantage point of that separation from Rome, I'm speaking of the geographical separation, and also a theological separation from Rome, because Augustine had no feeling about telling the so-called popes what to do. And when he thought they were wrong, he made it very clear that they were wrong. He was by no means theologically or geographically dependent upon Rome. And in his day, that little town in North Africa overwhelmed Rome in its theological importance. Having said that, then, let's look at Augustine. Now, I will fully admit that in his early days, Augustine only faintly saw the implications of Christianity, as so far as its cultural mandate is concerned. He brought within the church Neoplatonism, Manichaeism, Gnosticism, and his own erring ways. He had tasted, as he said, and he had drunk of all the heresies, all the classical heresies, all the classical streams. Of course, this helped him in the long run because he knew them. He didn't have to take second information as to what they were like. He had been there. Within a very few years after he became Bishop of Rome, the threatened fall of Rome became a reality. In 378 A.D., for the first time in over 700 years, a Roman army had been defeated on Roman soil. The Emperor Valens had been killed in battle. He was replaced by a well-meaning Christian emperor, Theodosius the Great, who struggled to hold the empire together. But in 395, Theodosius died. And he divided the empire for the final time between his two sons, generally along what we call the Greek-speaking and the Latin-speaking lines. And this was the final division of the empire. And in 410, the Visigoths walked in to Rome, sacked part of the city, and the empire, for all practical purposes, was gone. Great was the fall thereof. To the Roman mind, Christian and pagan, the idea that Rome, the eternal city of seven hills, could fall was unbearable. You can imagine it. We've been looking to Washington since 1800, when they actually took the capital of Washington. 173 years. We have been trying to look up to Washington to see what's going on. Rome had been the capital of the Republic and the Empire for at least seven centuries. And the Romans had been well addicted, well trained to look at Rome. Suddenly, the Rome that they had known is no more. It's there, but its glory is gone. Its grandeur departed. And it's very difficult for us to imagine the psychological impact of the fall of Rome. The Western Emperor looked at the situation, and he took off his chariot on Italian Interstate Number 1 up to Ravenna. And he left Rome to his fate. There emerged, however, a very able pope, a well-meaning pope, and a very brave pope, who went out and dickered with the Visigoths and persuaded Arian that they didn't really want to demolish the whole city. But the impact remained. And so Augustine began to write his famous De Civitate Dei, probably the greatest single Christian statement of the meaning of history that was ever penned. Now, how did he do it? He did it because after 410, though the state may be debatable, in the last 20 years of his life, he began to really plummet the depths of biblical theology. He began to see what it meant. And so he threw off gradually, but successfully for the most part, the shackles of Platonism, the shackles of Gnosticism, the shackles of Neoplatonism, the shackles of Manichaeism, which was a dualistic pagan system. And so, using the fall of Rome, he writes to the Christians not to be defeated in their thinking, not to think that the fall of Rome was the great tragedy that people thought it was, but rather was it a vindication of the glory of God. And so, as he wrote that book, which took him 14 years to write, incidentally, he began it in 412 and finished in 426, because of his deep understanding of the Scriptures, an understanding which grew constantly deeper as he plummeted ahead in the writing of this great work, Augustine was able to apply to the great issues of history a biblical interpretation. He was able to come up with answers which classical scholarship had been totally unable to achieve. Basic to his biblical view of history, then, are his doctrines of God and creation. Without the biblical doctrine of God, a valid interpretation of the realm and the meaning of history is utterly impossible. Without the doctrine of creation, history becomes meaningless, because in creation, God implanted meaning in his creation, a meaning which we are under a mandate to find. He gave purpose to history. You see, an impersonal deity, such as that of Herodotus, can never possibly confer meaning in history. It's impersonal. And so all Greek history is deterministic. All Greek political thought is deterministic for this reason. But Augustine freed both historical thought and political thought from the shackles of determinism, replacing with a sovereign God. In his understanding of the Trinity, in his ontological Trinity, he furnished the Christian church with a basic insight. In his understanding of the Trinity, in his ontological Trinity, he furnished the Christian church with a basic insight in the nature of the historical process, which had been lacking to classical scholars. Dr. Lee made much of this. I made much of it. You see, in the ontological doctrine of the Trinity, I hope I'm not intruding upon your prerogative. In the ontological doctrine of the Trinity, you have the essence of personality. The Greeks had no real concept of personality. Augustine brought the biblical view of personality to the forefront because he, in his De Trinitate, developed, as no other father of the church had been able to do, the biblical doctrine of the Trinity. And he applied this to his view of history. So, you have, therefore, a personal God dealing with persons, not with impersonal entities, not an impersonal determinism producing either chance or fate, but a personal God guarding and guiding his creation. As I said the other day, the Trinitarian doctrine which Augustine presented from the Scriptures furnished the study of history with an insight which was lacking before. It solved the problem of the one and the many in ancient philosophy and made history possible as we know it. Incidentally, it is because modern historians have forgotten the doctrine of God that history has become them a hopeless puzzle beyond any interpretation. History is not the subject, to the dictates of fate or of chance. And in these doctrines, Augustine rescued a whole writing and study of history from the grip of the classical concept of determinism, which could render history, and which did render history, meaningless, irrational, and without purpose. Now we come to his central themes in history. His central theme is the great division of the human race into two groups, into two cities, the Kiwitas Dei, the city of God, and the Kiwitas Therena, the city of man, the earthly city. All of history revolves around these two cities. I might add that the Kiwitas Dei in Augustine is not to be confused with institutional church. Now, I would admit that Augustine did not always make this clear. He did emphasize the institutional church, but at no time did he link these two together. The Roman Catholic Church, I think, is in serious error when they claim Augustine this point. I have the original edition of the City of God in Latin. I used it as a course for a seminar which I took, in which I, in college, the professor said he had never read Augustine. I said, all right, if you'll give me a seminar in Augustine, I will read the Latin for you, and you can give me the instruction in the Latin language. And he said, all right, I will do that if you'll instruct me in Augustine's theology. So on that bargain, I did it. I also had tea for him in my dormitory suite, a tea which he said was so strong that when he put his knife in it, stood up straight, he gave up that part of the bargain for his own self-protection. He didn't appreciate that. History is the scene of a continuing conflict between these two cities. The city of man, the city of evil, the city of darkness, as over against the city of God, the city of light, the city of life, the city of the elect. The city of God is composed of the elect of all ages, those which have gone on, those which were living in his own day, and those which would yet be born. Thus, he provided, first of all, an institution around which all historical events revolve, and that is the city of God. And, of course, this is basic to his approach. You see, what he's telling the Roman Christians of his day, the city of Rome is either gone or on its way. Don't worry about Rome. Because the real city in which we hold our citizenship is the city of God on earth, the body of the elect. This, I think, is a thing we need to remember and to cling to as we interpret history in our own day. Building on that, he then came to this, that all events in history have reference to the city of God. He made a great deal of that tremendous doctrine in Galatians, in which, when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son in the world. All history, said Augustine, that of Babylon, Egypt, Syria, Alexander, Thebes, Athens, Sparta, name it what you will. All the confluent terms or streams of history in what we call the ancient world had to do with the preparation for the coming of Jesus Christ and the emergence of the church. And he furthermore saw that Jesus Christ came at the beginning of the great Pax Romana. You must remember that he was born in the very early days of the Emperor Caesar Augustus, who instituted 200 years of peace for the Roman classical world. Do you realize that the Mediterranean world has never had such a period since? Never had it since. Augustus furnished it from possibly even India to Spain. He furnished political peace. It didn't pay to interfere with Roman citizens. You may remember when Paul gently told his jailers at Philippi that they'd just beaten up a Roman citizen. They were trying to figure out, they went to the city father and said, we better get this man out of town. We just made a mistake. Well, they had. And you may remember that when the big debate later on Acts, whether to send him to Rome or not, when Felix and Festus were arguing it out, and they said, really, we see no reason to send him to Rome. This man's guilty of nothing in the Roman law. But what did they say? He's appealed to Caesar. And to Caesar he must go. If under the imperial law you failed to give a man the right of appellate jurisdiction to the imperial court at Rome, you, as a Roman governor, a Roman deputy, were in dire danger. If you beat a Roman citizen without getting him due process of law, you were in real trouble. And the city fathers at Philippi were fully aware of the fact they were in dire trouble. They had just beaten up a Roman citizen. And not one who bought it. He had a birthright, Roman citizenship. And they suddenly realized that they were in for it. They couldn't get him out of town and shut him up. Roman law took its course. And under the early emperors, in spite of what we hear, for Roman citizens, on the whole, is well enforced. And with 200 years of peace, Paul, the other apostles, could go out and around and preach the gospel in comparative safety. Probably in greater safety than you could if you went to the Arab states today. Much more so. If you go to Macedonia today, you have the problems of the Russian threat. You have upheavals in Greece. You have the terrible uproar in the Middle East, Northern Africa, and so on, between the various groups. Not in that day. They handled it. He goes on like this to show you, or to show the Romans, why the golden age of Imperial Rome, so far as he can see, is the fullness of time for the coming of Jesus Christ. Augustine then says to us that there are no accidents in history. All events have reference to the Decivitas Dei. There's no such thing as an accident in history. There's no such thing as fate in history. There's no such thing as chance in history. History has meaning and purpose, and every event has meaning in the will of God, as it is referred in some way to the preparation for the coming of Jesus Christ, or after that, to the church. Now, of course, he could not predicate all that because he was living in the midst of Paul of Rome, but he saw very clearly the biblical background for it. Augustine furnished something for the writing of history that had never had before. And that was an eschatology, a doctrine of last things. History has a catastrophic and yet climactic ending in the final triumphant return of Jesus Christ in glory, at which time he will judge the civitas terrena with a finality of complete vindication of the righteous and of the final punishment of those who do not believe. This eschatological outlook, of course, is a vital part of his whole inquiry into the nature of history. If all events look backward to the incarnation, they also look forward to this final catastrophic return of Jesus Christ and his vindication and glory. He wrote in the City of God, Ad gloriam Dei omnia referenda est, translating, all things must be referred to the glory of God. And he was speaking there of the events of history. And then he wrote these tremendous words, Gratia et electio sunt essentia et mysterium historiae. Translating, grace and election are the essence and the mystery of history. And you see, he refers all these things to the glory of God. And this constitutes him the basic approach, the basic faith, the basic understanding by which the Christian, you and I, must seek to understand history in the light of the Bible. The doctrine of election, the doctrine of foreordination, the doctrine of divine providence, the doctrine of the incarnation, the doctrine of justification, although not clearly expressed as inherent, his great doctrine of salvation by grace and grace alone, is splashed over almost all his works, particularly his later works. And he comes this triumphant outcry, Omnia ad gloriam Dei referenda est, the perfect passive periphrastic. All things must be referred to the glory of God. I suppose at this time I should stop for today's lecture.